President Trump tonight escalating his trade war with China, threatening new tariffs that they're coming soon, and they are sweeping. The Dow reacting immediately to the news today, plunging, closing down 280 points.
164,000 jobs added in the month of July.
Home value appreciation is now back to positive at the very least, and that could be due in part because of low mortgage rates keeping it attractive for buyers.
Yeah.
The rub is, though, that low mortgage rates mean that the monthly payment is much more affordable. It does nothing to that down payment affordability.
So in other words, instead of the pricing correcting to a level at which more people could afford it, the low rates are keeping that pricing high and maybe keeping people locked out.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, they met, they cut, and they confused. As the Fed cut interest rates for the first time since 2008, trade tensions rise as the president threatens to add another 10% tariff on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods beginning this September. Market's not liking this news. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in this program today, Tom McClellan will be joining us. He's saying we're going to head into a correction here into that August 5th, August 8th period. But he says overall, we're in the third year of a presidential election. That means stocks could be heading higher into the end of the year. And Mark Chandler will be joining us. And even though you're seeing the dollar breaking out, Mark thinks the dollar is in the middle of a topping process, could be heading lower. And Mark likes gold, and he's here to tell you why. And of course, Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets later on in the program. Chris and I will be talking in the big picture and dissecting the press conference and the FOMC meeting. And we're calling it, they met, they cut, and they confused. All of that coming up in today's program.
Well, let's welcome back Ryan Poplava to review this week's financial market catalysts.
Thanks, Chris. We knew this week was going to be chock full of big news with the Fed policy decision Wednesday. We also knew that employment data could potentially move the markets Friday. But little did we know that the biggest influence on the market this week would be the trade tweet from Trump. Okay, let's try that again. Little do we know that the biggest influence on the market this week would be a trade tweet from Trump on Thursday to raise tariffs 10% on $300 billion of goods from China. Though he did drop some hints earlier in the week that the Chinese weren't making positive steps to buy agricultural products post the G20 agreement in June.
Okay, so the Fed dropped rates a quarter point and, you know, investors expected that. What caused the initial drop, though, after the policy statement? Was it just buy the rumor, sell the news? I mean, I think this is the question that most of us are asking. And then what did Powell say at the press conference that caused the selling to actually even accelerate?
Well, I think, Chris, the initial drop was part sell the news, like you said, but also part disappointment in the Fed not cutting 50 basis points, as well as no overt language that the Fed will do more cuts. There was a lot of back and forth in the Fed futures and media whether the Fed could go and cut 50 basis points in the weeks leading up to this week, but I don't think we're economically hurting enough for it to really happen. You know, the last time I remember the Fed doing a big cut like that at the onset of a rate cutting cycle was back in September of 2007. And from obviously much higher starting point at, I think it was 5.25 at the time, with, you know, much dire background with subprime just capitulating. So two Fed presidents dissented at this meeting. So that was Rosengren and George, who wanted to keep rates the same. One surprise we got was that the balance sheet reduction efforts have ended. In fact, it's done as of this week, as of August 1st. And that's 2 months ahead of schedule, with plans to roll over all principal payments from Fed Treasury securities and reinvest all principal payments from agency and mortgage-backed securities. So the drop post the conference, that other part you asked, was in reference to a comment Powell said at the press conference that this was not the start of a prolonged rate cutting cycle as one might see heading into or in a recession, but rather a mid-cycle adjustment, some insurance, as he put it. So the bar is set a little higher for another rate cut than traders were thinking. So this cut doesn't have the dovish tilt, as you will, many were hoping it would. Because of that, we saw the U.S. dollar break out to new 52-week highs, and we also saw the 10-year Treasury drop from 2% down to 1.85% later this week.
Well, and that good news of the market starting to rally Thursday, it was after the post-Fed dip before the tariff announcement, but President Trump said he'll initiate a 10% tariff on another $300 billion of imported Chinese goods. That's beginning September 1st. What are the immediate takeaways from the announcement? And Ryan, how did the market take it?
So this latest tranche of tariffs will impact many consumer-oriented goods, which is what he's kind of avoided with the first tranche of tariffs, you know, the 25% now, which could hit one of the strongest engines for growth in the U.S. right now. You know, that's 70% of the economy is consumption. The risk of retaliation from China is definitely one issue, and it's definitely up. And there were a couple of spokespeople from China stating that on Friday. Now, Trump likes to hit hard up front and then offer a lighter message post the hit, maybe give a little chance. Well, hey, you know, if we come to the agreement table, bring a few things here, we can possibly roll back. But Larry Kudlow tried to do that on Friday morning on Fox Business, that a lot of good things could happen before the tariffs go into effect. And he also said that they have models to show that the impact to U.S. consumers will be small. So trade war is still ongoing and deeply entrenched. That's why we're seeing the market pull back here. Employment data Friday was good, with an increase of 164,000, just above the three-month average, which is around 140,000, but not weak enough to convince the Fed to cut again in September. Trade, I think, is the bigger reason right now. In addition to, you know, interest rate differentials between us and other countries, I was looking at the 10-year sovereign German bond, and it was somewhere near like almost 0.5% negative to hold those bonds, and got into quite a bit of a discussion with that with one of our traders. Just why would you want to do that? And not to mention that we've also got a partially inverted yield curve that should give the Fed plenty of reasons to follow through with more cuts.
Well, it's an interesting time. You know, we've got cuts, but we've got tariffs and this market seesaw going on. So, Ryan, thank you for coming into the studio today, breaking everything down for us. We appreciate it much, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
I mean, that's what separates the housing market, you know, writ large from other industries. You know, if there is a sudden increase in demand for Coca-Cola, you know, or for Greek yogurt, producers can be pretty quick in increasing the supply of Coca-Cola or Greek yogurt. You know, it only takes, you know, maybe weeks or months for those producers to ramp up supply to meet demand. The housing market works very different. Housing is a very complex good. It requires a lot of both tangible and intangible inputs that can be difficult to acquire. And most importantly, those inputs need to come together harmonically at a certain point in time to make the supply happen. So when we talk about the complex inputs, you know, we're talking about not just land and the materials to build that land, to build homes, but we're also talking about the labor to put those materials together to build the homes and put them on the land.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, Well, you don't know if it's buy the rumor, sell the news, but the Fed cut interest rates as widely expected this week by a quarter of a point, but the market didn't like what the Fed Chairman Powell had to say in the aftermath. What does all this mean? Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. And Tom, you sent us a couple charts that we're going to put on the website so our viewers can follow along. But the first one you sent me is the S&P in the current period. And then you make reference to where we were last year around this time. So what is the significance of this chart and what is it telling you?
That blue plot is what happened to the stock market in Clinton's term, first term, from 1993 to 95, and we're comparing it on a calendar day basis to what is happening now in President Trump's first term. And there's a whole lot of similarity, except for that inverted period in the fourth quarter of last year. The market went through something strange at that time, and now it's back on track. It's back following the proper agenda. And this downturn that we're seeing right now in the wake of the FOMC decision is right on schedule with a little soft spot in the uptrend that we had in 1995. That 1995 uptrend was a great uptrend. It was a wonderful, strong uptrend, but it wasn't a linear one. So there were stumbling blocks and a little bit of texture along the way. So we're seeing varying degrees of texture this time, but we're basically still following the same script.
Now, you have another chart, and that's the presidential election cycle pattern. And usually the third year of a cycle is a good year so far. That's proving to be the case. But you're also talking that there could be a scary feeling decline coming up here in the 1st of August. So let's talk about that and what would cause that.
We're in that scary feeling decline right now with the Fed not doing what it's supposed to do, with President Trump enacting tariffs that we weren't expecting. There's all sorts of horrible things going on and the market's going to crash and we're all going to die and we should get out now. That's the feeling that the market tries to create for us every August of the third year. And we get a little dip into about the first or second week in August. We're doing that right now. It's right on schedule. So even though you hear a lot of alarmed language on CNBC and the other networks about what's happening in the stock market, it's all happening right on schedule. And the mission of a little decline like this is to get everyone's hair on fire and make them think that the sky is falling and the world is going to come to an end. And once the market has accomplished that and get them feeling that way, then we can get back to having an uptrend again.
As you look at this, the market didn't obviously like what the Fed is saying. But Tom, I wonder if you have any historical charts. Typically, when the Fed first starts to cut interest rates, the market does predictably well in the 6 months or 12 months following the rate cut.
Well, yeah, that rule is generally true over time. If you look back long enough, it didn't work that way back in 2007 when the Fed was really, really late to get the party started on cutting rates. And they were way behind the power curve and it didn't work that time. But other times, if you go back further in time, it's been okay. 1995 was an example. There was a rate cut in 1995, and the market did just fine. It wasn't a sign that impending great recession was on the way. It just was getting the rates adjusted to where they needed to be. The Fed should have cut a half a point this time, and we know that because the two-year Treasury note yield is a great indicator of what the Fed ought to do. If they would just outsource the decision-making about setting interest rates, instead of having the 12 people in the FOMC sitting around opining about what they think it should be, just do what the two-year note yield says, and they would have a lot more accurate setting of interest rates because the bond market conveys messages about scarcity and or oversupply of money and credit, and it does a much better job. The two-year note yield is currently below 2%. The Fed moved in that direction, but it didn't move far enough, and they're going to have more cuts ahead, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, because the market is basically saying, it's not just going to be one, even though Powell sort of implied maybe we could have more rate cuts. He really went out yesterday, Tom, saying that, hey, no, this isn't the beginning of a long rate-cutting cycle. But the market is arguing otherwise. If you look at what the futures is telling us, there are more rate cuts ahead of us.
The tendency among all humans, we're all guilty of it, and the FOMC certainly is too, is that if you spend a lot of money to buy a tool like a PhD in economics, you think that it's a useful tool and that you ought to use it. And so they think that they're pretty smart and they know better than the market does. But history keeps showing that the market knows better than humans do about making predictions. And so we should learn to listen to the useful message of the market. You have a lot to unlearn when you have a PhD in economics. That's a normal human failing that we're all guilty of to some extent.
So in the short term, you expect that maybe in the next week or two, as we're going through now, this is the second day of a downturn today. It was a presidential tweet on 10% tariffs on $300 billion of Chinese goods. But outside that, we go through this brief correction. It'll scare you out. Obviously, the financial media is making this into be, oh my God, what could be coming next? But you expect the markets to head higher afterwards.
I do. We got a few more days of work to do to get the job fully done. From some separate predictive indicators that I developed years ago, we're looking for a bottom somewhere around August 5th to the 8th. We're a little bit early now, but there's just a little bit more time yet to run. We got the VIX all the way up to 18. That's a nice bit of work for today. But my guess is a few more days of scariness, and I don't know exactly what the nature of the scariness will be. There'll be some other news that'll come forward that'll get everybody's hair on fire. And that serves a useful purpose to make prices cheaper and make the reentry point for those of us on the sidelines or short to flip back to the bullish side.
If we take a look at where we are on the two-year Treasury note, it's falling. And as you said, it's basically telling the Fed, hey, this is where interest rates are going, whether you like it or not. And I look at the futures market and the bond market as knowing more than the PhDs at the Fed. So given that you expect higher markets ahead, do you see anything that really stands out in terms of sectors? Because, Tom, as we take a look at some of the top performing sectors this year, it's been technology, and especially some of the big, what I call FANG stocks, the Apple, the Googles, the Amazons. But also on the conservative side, and maybe this has to do with lower interest rates, you have staples doing well. You have utilities doing well. You have REITs doing well. So you've got sort of like a safety trade and a growth trade going on at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. And you do get rotation among sectors. Where I would be cautious as we get to the late part of this uptrend is you worry about the small caps and the junk bonds not doing well. Currently, they're not showing any signs of trouble in junk bonds, but small caps have been lagging behind, mostly because a lot of what drives the Russell 2000 index, which is our small cap benchmark, are small banks, and they are very much affected by Fed policy. And so that explains a lot of the underperformance that we're seeing there. But I would think that consumer discretionary, once we get to the turning point and turn back up again, I would think that consumer discretionary should start leading the way higher again. But we're not to that turning point yet.
And, you know, that is the one thing. It's almost like if you look at the manufacturing sector, it is definitely in the doldrums. But if you look at the consumer sector, unemployment, the lowest it's been in 50 years, wages are going up, consumers are spending according to retail sales, and that's 2/3 of the economy. So if these things are still in place as we head into the fall and the Christmas season, should be a Merry Christmas for a lot of retailers.
It should be. But, you know, when we have to have one of these little seasonal corrections like we're having right now, the investors and the news media have to worry about something. So they find something to fulfill the mission of giving them something to worry about. And we should not be surprised by that. And we should not be overly literal in how we interpret what they say the risk is. It's just the nature of the media and the nature of the storytellers that there has to be a story and it has to be related to whatever the market's doing. And so they must be linked together, even though there's background forces that are really driving it have been driving it consistently in the same way year after year, and we're used to seeing it. You just have to learn how to decode it, and that's what we try to do for all of our subscribers in our subscription publications.
Now, you sent me another chart, and let's talk about this, and that's the gold chart. So we've got gold on this day heading higher. You know, for a long time, it had a difficult time getting over 1350, 1360. We're clearly over 1400 and holding, and it looks like breaking out again.
It does look like that. But I'm very suspicious of it because the commercial traders of gold futures, the big money guys, they're very suspicious of it. They're net short in a huge way, according to the data in the Commitment of Traders report that the CFTC publishes every week. We won't know what this week's numbers are until the report comes out Friday afternoon. But so this chart reflects the data as of last week's report. And the commercials are holding a huge net short position. They are often early in getting to a big skewed position like this, but they are nearly always proven right when they do that. So I'm very suspicious of that gold is not making a legitimate breakout right now and is going to have to give back a bunch of the recent gains.
So it broke out above 1350, broke out over 1400. And if it was to break down, how far do you see it going?
We try to focus on the when more than the how far. Right now, one of the biggest non-confirmations of the strength that we're seeing in gold is that usually gold prices move in sympathy with the Japanese yen. and the Japanese yen has not made a higher high. It's made a divergent lower high, and when the two disagree, it's usually the yen that ends up being proven right about both where both of them are headed. Whether or not gold realizes that yet, eventually that divergence is going to matter. It just hasn't mattered yet.
You know, something that really strikes me about this market statistic that just came out last week, Tom, this will be one of the biggest years for money flowing into bond funds by individual investors, close to $500 billion. And that is equal to the $1.2 trillion that went into bond funds since 2010. And yet the big gains have been in the stock market. In fact, if you're looking for yield, when you're talking about treasuries below 2%, I mean, Tom, I can look at staples, REITs, utilities, energy stocks and get dividend yields at 3.5%, 4.5%, all the way to 5% and 6%. So a lot of investors have not been on board this rally. What would you be saying to them now?
Well, it hasn't hurt them that much because bonds have actually done pretty well in the last 2 or 3 months. As yields are falling, the bond prices are rising, and so it's all fine until it stops working. There's a big demographic shift going on. The baby boom generation, or those of us who were born between 1946 and 1964. So if you start doing the math, those people are getting up into their late 50s and early 60s when everybody knows you're supposed to switch out of risky stock market investments and switch into interest-bearing bonds. And so if everybody's making that switch en masse all at once, then you get the flow situation that you were referring to where everybody's all rushing through the door at the same time. They're going to get a big surprise because wherever the boomers stand, they kind of tip over the boat a little bit. They can only go so far. We saw that with the housing bubble. Now we're seeing it with the bond rush. We saw it with tech stocks that they were all rushing into in the 80s and 90s. So the boomers have a big effect. And what we're going to see soon is that we saw a big shortage as the echo boom generation starts to come into the housing market, for example. Another peak in the birth rate in 1989 to 90, when boomers like me were having kids. And so all those kids that came in the echo boom, they all wanted to buy their first time starter home, and nobody could find any because they were all getting bought up. And so now, pretty soon, you're going to see all those kids that bought their first-time starter homes want to sell it to the next generation, and there won't be as many of them, so we're going to see some disruption there. But they're also going to upgrade to their second home with maybe another bedroom because they got kids coming along the way. At the same time, all of us boomers, we're all going to want to sell out of our McMansions and retire to a two-bedroom condo somewhere where that doesn't need a ride-on vacuum cleaner. And we're going to be looking for who wants to buy all these bigger homes, you know, your third or your fourth home. And there aren't enough of those echo boom 1990 kids yet who are in the age range and the salary range to be able to do that. So you're going to see big disruption in the real estate market, locally especially, and in varying ways around the country. But that's the next story that hasn't really hit yet.
So, Tom, from your perch, you expect in the short term here a correction leading into that August 5th, 8th period. But after that, you expect it to head up. The consumer's doing pretty strong. So if you were an investor, I suppose that you would say just stay the course. Or if you have any new money to deploy, you might want to take advantage if stocks pull back.
And you know, that's a really good point about market timing. I get into forecasts of times and dates, but that doesn't mean you need to trade your entire account on every little wiggle. However, you can be strategic about, okay, I got some buying to do. I don't necessarily need to do it today just because I have the money today. Let me look for the right spot to put it in. Or I'm going to need to cash out to pay for junior's college tuition in the fall. When's the right time to sell some stock? So you look for your tops and bottoms that way, for not for trading the entire portfolio, but for looking for where you got to be strategic and tactical about what you're doing. And so, yeah, I'm expecting that the soft spot that we're working on right now, it'll get even softer in another few days, bottoming sometime next week, sometime around the 5th to the 8th. And we may not go straight back up again out of that bottom. We may stumble around for the rest of August. August and September are typically weak and seasonally, a little bit less so in the third year of a presidential term where we find ourselves now. But yeah, that's a good time if there's cash you're looking to put to work. That's when you should be looking to do it. You should be start making your shopping list now for what you're going to put it into. But you don't want to pull the trigger just quite yet.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as we close, tell people about your website and your newsletter.
Well, come to our website, mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of McLellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed back in 1969. You can read lots of free articles. You can sign up for our free weekly chart and focus email, and we don't send anybody any spam or marketing at all. It's just another way of getting people acquainted with our work. Or if you want the good stuff, you can get our twice-monthly newsletter, the McLellan Market Report. We also have a daily edition that comes out every day, and you can sign up for those at the subscriptions page.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, thanks for coming on the program. Have yourself a great rest of the summer.
Thank you, Jim.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
That means we're looking at the service side of the economy playing catch up with the manufacturing and increased probability of a recession. Now, again, I want to point out, we're not seeing that yet. This is just how those dominoes would fall. And these would be the indicators and the signs that we're moving in that direction. If that happens, again, we'll see, instead of the Fed just cutting once as they did yesterday of 25 basis points, well, then we should expect them to cut another 25 basis points or perhaps 50 basis points, depending on how bad of a slowdown we see. Now, at this point, it doesn't look like that is a high probability scenario, but that could take place. And again, these are all the different things we're going to be watching.
Well, on this Friday, markets are tumbling, concerns over trade and tariffs coming up, but we have the dollar breaking out. Joining us is Chief Market Strategist and Managing Partner at Bannockburn Partners, Mark Chandler. Mark, let's begin with the dollar because it is breaking out on this Friday despite a cut in the Fed funds rate. So let's begin with the dollar. What's your take here?
Yes, what an amazing week, huh? The dollar yen had been trading 107 to 109 for the last several months. And we poked through 109.30 or so, as high as we got, and completely reversed after a combination of the FOMC, Powell's comments, and then the end of the tariff truce. And so we began then with this head fake to the upside, and we're finishing the week, I should say, with the dollar down to 106.50 against the yen. It's a big swing here, all based on things happening here in the U.S.
You know, it was thought, Mark, originally, and this happened, I would say a little over a month ago, when the Fed first became apparent to the markets that they were going to cut interest rates, the dollar fell, and it was thought that this would weaken the dollar, that would make the president happy. Well, here we are, the Fed cut interest rates, and the dollar is breaking out. How much of this has to do with the fact that in the U.S., things are better? Economically, our economy is better than Europe, Japan. And secondarily, our interest rates, even though the 10-year Treasury is down to 2%, it looks like a junk bond yield when you compare one-third of global sovereign debt is negative.
Yeah, now what a strange world we live in, huh?
Yeah.
I never thought, negative interest rates are still like boggling my mind. But I think that a couple of things are happening. You know, and I take this from a lot of my friends. I don't golf, but a lot of my friends do. And they tell me that you drive for show and you putt for dough. And what I take that to mean in foreign exchange is that, you know, I can tell you that in my big picture view of the dollar, that I think that the third big dollar rally that we've had since the end of Bretton Woods is at its final stages. I think it's over. But in the short run, I think you're right. The dollar looks like it was breaking out to the upside, but I'm not convinced that it's going to happen. You know, we got down to almost, I think it was 110.20 on the euro, which is a new low for the year. It's a new like 18-month low. And it looks to me now that we're going to finish the week above 111 again. So I think that up until the new tariffs that President announced, I would have to agree with the picture you'd cast. The U.S., it might be an ugly contest, but the U.S. is the least ugly. But I think that with these latest tariffs, what the market's saying is that not only will the Federal Reserve cut rates in September, but they also have completely priced in another one after that. And remember, there's three meetings left this year for the Federal Reserve. The market is pricing in two cuts and is about 50% towards pricing in that third one. So three meetings coming up, and the market thinks two are a done deal and maybe a 50-50 chance on the next one. In this time, then, what will the ECB do? Well, they might cut 20, they might cut 20 base, 10 to 20 basis points, putting their deposit rate at minus 50 to minus 60 basis points. Japanese may cut rates a little bit, but not until later this year when we see the effect of the sales tax increase. I think other countries in emerging markets, I've already saw some countries cut interest rates. We'll see more, I think. We saw Brazil cut this past week. The market was expecting 25. They cut 50. And I think we'll see another round of rate cuts throughout Asia. The Chinese slowdown, the tariffs, the trade uncertainty, the scope the Fed gives them, I think we'll see further rate cuts. And so I think that we're in a position again where it's lower for longer on rates.
You know, this is an interesting scenario because we have the dollar breaking out today, and yet we have gold prices rising. So typically they travel in opposite directions. But right now, you have the dollar and gold both going up. So maybe gold is sniffing out this kind of currency war that we've got going on between countries. What's your take on gold, given what's happening to the dollar?
You know, I'm not a gold bug, but when I look around the markets, I say, where could I get 20%? And it seemed to me that when gold got above $1,400 an ounce, that was the big breakout. And I could understand it also from my macro point of view, understanding that interest rates would be lower for longer, so that reduced the opportunity cost for holding gold. I see that the global economic tension, they're looking for an alternative to the U.S. dollar. That's the large central banks like China, Russia are buying gold. So I thought that it looked to me like, technically, it looked to me like gold was breaking out to the upside. And so I was thinking we're on our way to $1,700. And it also does match my view that the dollar also is carving out some kind of top. And that's why I think it's important about what you're saying here today about the price action, because you're right. You know that the dollar index made it to almost up to 99. That's a couple year high. That's also the objective of a head and shoulders technical bottom pattern I was looking at, came very close to meeting that. And then we sold off on the back of those tariffs, because what the market understands those tariffs to mean is two things. It means a slower U.S. economy, and it means that the Federal Reserve is going to cut rates more. And so the dollar, after coming close to that 99 yesterday, is today trading 98.14. And so I think that we might have seen a near-term high for the dollar index, and that we spend the month of August sort of a wait-and-see mode, waiting to see how the Chinese respond, waiting for September when the ECB is going to cut interest rates, waiting for sort of get a clearer sense of how the economy is. We had a decent jobs report today, but the underlying idea from the hours worked is that the strength of the jobs market might not be spilling over to help output.
Here's something that I find interesting, because there was a little bit of confusion in the press conference that followed the FOMC meeting. And that was Powell kind of went out of his way and said, no, this is not the beginning of a long rate cutting cycle. So the market was a little bit confused. But I'm looking at the futures market right now. And for the September meeting, Mark, there's a 98.1% probability that we may get a 50 basis point cut in September. So I tend to lean more towards the futures market than I do than what the Fed says. What do you think happens?
So for me, what happened was that I think you're right. The market was confused from what Powell said. I think they were disappointed that he made sound. He used these words about a mid-cycle adjustment. And in the lexicon, the nomenclature of the Federal Reserve, that has a specific reference. And that is a 95 and a 98, both times. Greenspan talked about a mid-cycle adjustment, and it involved three rate cuts, 75 basis points in total. And I think that the area that Powell wanted to go into by talking about that, by referring to it as a mid-cycle adjustment. Now, I think that what changed, though, is that the tariffs that the president announced, I think when the tariffs were announced, the market quickly made this adjustment on those interest rates that you're talking about. To give you just a sense of what I mean here is that on that Fed Funds futures contract, the September contract, a big adjustment in the last couple of days to basically bring us back to where we were last Friday. Last Friday, that September contract closed at 97.95, and right now it's trading 97.96. And so I think that between Powell, and you're right about the confusion, I think that what was generated, and the president's tariffs, they were back to where we were before, and that is market is anticipating, like I say, two more rate cuts and possibly a third one. Still this year, I think that the market does not accept Powell's assessment of the economy. The market has been all along more dovish than the Federal Reserve. And I think the tariffs gave them, that is the market, that's what we're looking at when we look at the Fed funds futures. I think that's what's giving the market the encouragement to press against this idea that this business cycle is not over.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the futures market. There's a high probability of 50 basis points in September, and then over a 50% probability that we get another quarter point either in October or December. So almost 75 basis points of cut, meaning a full percentage point cut in the Fed funds rate this year. And maybe that's what the gold market is telling us. Now, let me ask you this. Let's assume the Fed does cut again. So this is more than just one and done. But the ECB cuts, Switzerland is hinting that they may cut if their currency gets too strong. Japan is saying they may cut. Maybe that's what the gold market is telling us, is it's sort of like this rate cut to the bottom in currencies.
Yeah, so I, for me, what that means is that the easing of monetary policy, I mean, like, and you mentioned, I mean, we've got, what is it, about a quarter or a third of global bonds are at negative yields. Europe more so than Japan now. And we have to expect that to continue. New record low yields are being recorded today in some of the core bond markets. And so for me, that's made gold more attractive. And then when you couple this with, for me, the real threat to the U.S. dollar is not the threat of intervention, unilateral intervention, but it's really that the U.S. continues to weaponize access to the currency, to dollar funding. And this is going to encourage people to look for alternatives. And when people look for alternatives to the fiat currencies, to the dollar, I think gold becomes one of these things that people really believe. And you see this from the central banks. That's why I mentioned about Russia continuing to buy gold, China continuing to buy gold, that some people think that the new regime, the new international standard that's going to replace the dollar, may have a role or a larger role for gold. The U.S., of course, has the most gold in the world, about 8,000 tons of gold, which is the bulk of our currency reserves. Other countries like China have much lower levels of gold holdings and more paper money in their reserves. So my sense is that there are a lot of interesting reasons to buy gold, including these technical momentum type things. But I think so many people now have come out in favor of gold, including the Bridgewater. I see some of the investment banks. A lot of people, I think, have turned bullish gold. And we broke above 1,400. We got up to new highs this week. But this 1,450, 1,460 area looks kind of sticky now.
You know, this is interesting because you mentioned something that I believe to be true, which is that the U.S. is weaponizing the dollar. So you have countries like China that are now doing bilateral trade agreements between countries, whether it's Iran or other Asian countries, where they trade within their own currency. But what I found interesting, Mark, is they're also opening up the possibility of, let's say I own Chinese currency, I don't want to sit on it, I may be able to exchange it for gold. So China is opened up a futures market to trade oil in gold. Let's talk about the implications of that, because this is getting more towards an alternative to the U.S. dollar in international trade.
I see that. You know, and Japan has there's only one place you could trade a rubber contract in the world, and that's in Tokyo, and that's in yen. But here's how I kind of think about it these days, Jim, is that what I like about the foreign exchange market, $5 trillion a day, average daily turnover. It's the biggest market there is. And then I look at the market for goods and services, the kind of that used to drive the world economy, the kind of world economy that you and I grew up with. Goods and services crossed the border, and that was globalization, was about trade. But something happened along the way, the Reagan-Thatcher revolution, the financialization, so that the capital markets are so much bigger than the market for goods. So when I say the foreign exchange market, $5 trillion a day, average daily turnover, that's done. That means that this week alone, the foreign exchange market has seen the turnover to cover world trade for a year. And so when I think about what drives the currency markets, what's ultimately behind the dollar as the world's key reserve currency, as the numeraire in the world, I really think it's more capital flows than the flows of goods and services, including, I know some people think about the petrodollar. I really think that the role of the capital markets more important than the goods market. And I think the depth and breadth of the U.S. capital markets, the transparency of it, think about this. When the U.S. Treasury issues has an auction for a bond or a note, they might sell, say, $20 to $40 billion of it in one shot. When Europe issues a bond, a country issues a bond, it might be 10 billion euros, 15 billion euros at the most. And so the depth and breadth of the U.S. capital market, it still doesn't have a rival. I'd say the European bond market is more like the U.S. muni market. A lot of different small issuers, their own little rules about how they, how you do it in their country. Same thing with the U.S. states. So I really think that until China's bond market, and that means the broader capital markets are more transparent, less government influenced, that is more market driven, it will be hard for the Chinese currency to replace the dollar. And it's hard to imagine in my mind, maybe limited imagination, but I don't see how a basket or something else is going to be able to replace it. I think it has to be another national currency, and I just don't think China's up to the task yet.
So given what you see right now, what would you be doing as an investor? Would you be adding to a gold position or taking a position in gold? Would you be shorting the dollar as it looks like it's a short-term breakout here? What would you be doing?
Yeah, so that two things occur to me. But I it's hard for me to trade foreign exchange, but I do have some international wagers. And so one, as I say, with gold, I didn't want to commit a lot of money to it. I didn't have a lot of cash at the time. And so I bought the levered ETF that's basically two times gold. And so with a relatively modest sum of money, I can basically be leveraged two times by just and having the equity itself, right, the ETF. The other thing I'm thinking internationally is really about what's going on in Mexico. And so, as you know, Pemex, Mexico's biggest oil company, is having some real problems. And the government is standing behind it. And that is to say that I'm concerned that as a shareholder, Pemex might not look attractive. But I don't think the government is going to let Pemex default on its debt. And Pemex pays, because it's a low ranking, still investment grade, but just barely, the yield is high and for dollar-based investors, as well as the peso-denominated issue. And with this nice setback in the peso we're having in the last few days, I sort of think that the Pemex bond that has short duration or short maturity. So I just bought one for myself of a dollar-denominated issue, pays about 3.5%, and it's got about a year and a half left to its life. And so I'm thinking that the dollar is rolling over. So what I'm doing really, as well as I am stepping up my purchases, a dollar cost average into several international equity funds. So trying to diversify out of the U.S. equity market, because I think the dollar is no longer going to be a tailwind for me, going to be a headwind, and looking at some of those unhedged foreign equity ETFs and open-ended funds.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, if people like to follow the work that you do, and you've written several books, tell them about the books and how they can follow you, please.
Sure. So I have a blog that I update almost every day. It's called a Mark to Market, Mark with a C. Makes my mother happy. And so I'm right on there. I'm on Twitter at Mark Making Sense, which really comes from my first book called Making Sense of the Dollar. And I'm about to celebrate its 10th anniversary. And I anticipated back then, in the heart of the great financial crisis, that the dollar was going to go on a long-term bull market. And now I'm warning that bull market may be over. But I also want to look more in depth at how, like, where we are, where capitalism is, where we are in the bigger picture. And I wrote another book called Political Economy of Tomorrow. And it's really an interesting story because my protagonist worked at the same bank that I spent 15 years at, Brown Brothers Harriman. And this my protagonist, Charles Conant, was an advisor to the presidents. And he helped put China on a silver standard and helped put Nicaragua on a silver standard back at the turn of the century. So fascinating story there, trying to make sense of what's going on now, political economy of tomorrow.
All right, Mark. Well, listen, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thanks. Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye.
We decided today to lower the target for the federal funds rate by a quarter of a percentage point to a range of 2% to 2.25%. The outlook for the U.S. economy remains favorable, and this action is designed to support that outlook. The committee is really thinking of this as a way of adjusting policy to a somewhat more accommodative stance to further the three objectives that I mentioned, to ensure against downside risks, to provide support to the economy, that those factors are where factors are pushing down on economic growth, and then to support inflation. So we do think it'll serve all of those goals.
They met, they cut, and they confused. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Prytower, and welcome to The Big Picture as we dissect this week's FOMC meeting and press conference. And as widely expected, the Fed cut the Fed funds rate by a quarter of a point this week, and that's the first rate cut since 2008. It was widely anticipated, but disappointing as stocks continue to sell off as a result of the meeting, a prediction that was made by this week's technician, Tom McClellan, earlier in the broadcast. Now, this is the first rate cut in 11 years. Why did the Fed cut rates only a quarter of a point? Are there more rate cuts ahead of us? And with unemployment the lowest in a half a century, the economy still growing with no recession on the horizon and even no signs of inflation, what prompted this week's cut in rates? That is the subject of today's Big Picture. So, Jim, let's get into what was behind this week's rate cuts. And also, are there going to be more to follow?
Yeah, this was really a big deal. As you pointed out, Chris, this is the first time the Fed has cut interest rates in nearly 11 years. And you got to remember, they never really got interest rates that high when they were raising them. We got up to 2.5%, which is roughly about half of what the Fed normally does when it raises rates. If you go back to Greenspan and Bernanke before the financial panic, they raised the Fed funds rate to over 5%. This time around, which is a contention we have made since the beginning, they would never ever get up to what they were targeting. They were thinking 3.5 to 4%. There's just no way with the amount of debt. So I want to begin with a clip from the press conference when a reporter asked Jay Powell what changed to cause the Fed to go from raising rates. Now remember, in December, how hawkish the Fed was throughout 2018, and especially in the fall when they said this is on automatic pilot, QT is on automatic pilot. 2 weeks later, after the market was down 20%, they flipped. So they went from raising rates to cutting rates for the first time in 11 years in a period of 6 months. So reporters were saying, hey, what changed? Let's play that clip from the conference.
So I gave three reasons for what we did, and that is to insure against downside risks to the outlook from weak global growth and trade tensions. So that is, in a sense, that is a risk management point, and that is a bit of insurance. But we also feel like weak global growth and trade tensions are having an effect on the U.S. economy. You see it now in second quarter. You see weak investment. You see weak manufacturing. So support demand for it there.
There you have basically saying, look, a lot of stuff is happening overseas. It's impacting us here. Now, there's been a lot of mention lately by the Fed, as heard in that clip, as to what is happening overseas. Central banks around the globe are engaged in a currency war. Right now, no country wants a strong currency. So what are they doing? They're cutting rates and debasing their currencies, as so many developed countries are dependent on exports for economic growth. That's one advantage the U.S. economy enjoys, is we're less dependent on exports. We're more homegrown for our economic growth. Now, this week, the Swiss Central Bank, seeing what's going on in Europe, what's going on with the Fed, they threatened to weaken their currency if other central banks weaken theirs. And they began selling francs into the market this week in an effort to weaken their currency. A weaker currency helps these countries that export by making their goods cheaper. Now, here's something to look at. Rates, we're beginning this rate-raising cycle a little bit different than where we were in 2008. 2008, the Fed funds rate, or 2007 when the Fed began cutting, the Fed funds rate was at 5%. The ECB had a higher equivalent of Fed funds rate. As we look at where we're beginning now, the Fed only got to 2.5, and in Europe, their equivalent rate is a negative 0.4%. One-third of all global sovereign bonds have a negative yield, and nearly 25% of all aggregate global bonds are negative. So you're starting to hear a new term in international circles of something called Japanization, which is negative yields, deflation, and moribund economies, very much in terms of what we've seen happen in Japan since 1989. Now, right now, even though U.S. yields have fallen from the beginning of the year, where they were at 3.25%, to today, they're around 2%. It is much worse overseas. 10-year German bonds are a negative 0.5%. The 10-year gilt in the UK is about 0.6%. And in Japan, it's nearly a negative 0.2%. So money is flowing into the U.S., chasing yields that remain positive. And when you think about it, almost 3 full percentage points above major sovereign debt. Now, here's the consequences. As those dollars flow into the U.S., it helps to strengthen the U.S. dollar, and that has consequence. It's hurting corporate earnings of many of our U.S. S&P 500 companies or Fortune 500 companies because a firmer dollar is impacting their bottom line. We're about halfway through the corporate earnings season for Q2. The majority or 3/4 of S&P 500 companies have beaten their lowered estimates. Well, they always do that. That's the way the game is played. But according to FactSet, S&P 500 companies that generate more than half of their sales overseas are reporting double-digit earning declines for the 2nd quarter. So U.S. stocks are at record levels. They could be vulnerable to further earnings downgrades as margins feel the pain from a stronger dollar along with higher wages and, of course, the trade tensions that are coming into play with possible another 10% tariff added on, what is it, $300 billion of Chinese goods that could go into effect in September. Notice in the trade tensions, instead of leveling off and maybe everybody thinking there's a deal, both sides are taking a harder stance. Now, one of the aspects of the market's gains is that stocks have been heading higher. It's not due to increased earnings, but more that people are paying more. In other words, PE multiples are rising. And what is helping that is bond yields have fallen about 40% since the beginning of the year. So this market's rise has been driven more by expectations for the Fed slashing interest rates than anything else. So to sum up, they cut the Fed funds rate by 25 basis points to the 2 to 2.25% range, but they did a few other things. They cut the rate they pay banks on reserves held at the Fed from 2.35 to 2.1, hoping banks will actually push more credit out the doors, and they ended their QT. Now, in the last press conference, they said they would end QT at the end of September. In this week's press conference, they're going to cut QT 2 months earlier. They're going to begin and stop it beginning August 1st. So QT has officially stopped.
Well, the question I have is, does this week's quarter point reduction actually do it? And what comes next? I mean, the Fed chairman seemed to confuse the markets, even reporters, about their intentions and what comes next. Well, Jim, here's a sample of some of that confusion at the press conference.
Our system doesn't rely on our ability doesn't mainly rely on our ability to identify the right time in the cycle to trigger a countercyclical tool. We rely on, through the cycle, always on high capital and liquidity requirements. And I think that's a good thing to do. The idea of putting it in place so you can cut it, that's something some other jurisdictions have done, and it's worth considering. I think the United Kingdom in particular has a countercyclical capital buffer that's always on, but that the one point of it is that you can cut when there's a downturn and therefore give the banks more room. So this isn't something we've decided to do. It's just under consideration.
One of the terms, Chris, the Fed chairman used at the conference is this is a mid-cycle adjustment, similar to what happened in 1995-97. But here's the point. We're not in the middle of a business cycle, but we're more at the end of a business cycle that has been extended as a result of a number of factors. The tax cut that went into effect last year, increased fiscal spending. They increased fiscal spending in 2018 over a 2-year period by $300 billion. Now, that stimulus ends in September of this year. What did they just do last week? They increased and removed all the caps and restraints on fiscal spending, they are going to spend an additional $300 billion over the next 2 years, which is one reason why we have a $1 trillion deficit this year.
So at the end of the meeting, and we'll get to a few more clips here in a moment, but the Fed left more room for confusion. They hinted that there may be other rate cuts coming, but they went out of their way to state that this wasn't the beginning of a long rate-cutting cycle.
We've seen, though, that when there's a sharp confrontation between two large economies, you can see effects on business confidence pretty quickly and on financial markets pretty quickly. We saw that in June. But then we saw them unwind after that to some extent. You've seen it returning to a much lower temperature, I think. Again, with trade policy, we're just going to be watching and trying to assess the implications for the U.S. outlook.
So the futures market has been spot on this year, as with predicting what the Fed was most likely to do, including this week's quarter point rate cut. So, Jim, do you think more rate hikes are coming? I mean, if you do, how many do you think may be down the road?
Well, let's look at probably one of the best predictors in terms of what's going to be going on with the Fed, and that's the futures market. Right now, the futures market is predicting by less than 2% that there will be a quarter point cut in September. Here's the interesting factor. They're factoring in or predicting a 98% probability of a 50 basis point cut in September and a 50 to 55% chance of another rate cut coming in either October or December. So the futures market is basically saying about another three quarters or 75 basis points is going to take place before the end of the year. So it's my belief more rate cuts are coming, because if we're talking about, you know, you heard the Fed chairman talking about an insurance policy. Well, really, folks, is a quarter point going to cut or do anything or change anything dramatically? I don't think so. The U.S. still has the highest interest rates in the developed world by far, and that's serving to help keep the dollar elevated, which is what the president does not like, because he knows it hurts manufacturing, it hurts company profits. And anytime, you know, the dollar rises against other currencies or other central banks like the Swiss Central Bank or the ECB are saying they're going to start slashing rates, you get a flurry of tweets. It makes the president upset because he knows it impacts us here. So in answer to the question, are more rate cuts coming? The answer is yes, with the futures market predicting about another 0.75% cut coming before the end of the year, totaling 1 full percentage point of rate cuts. And folks, that is really significant. That is a 40% reduction of where the Fed was before this latest cut.
Well, one of the things that the chairman said that sent the market tumbling is when he said this is not the beginning of a rate cutting cycle. So based on that, if the Fed is cutting rates now, what happens if an actual recession actually arrives? I mean, what do they do if they've fired most of their bullets now when things are actually doing well?
Here's the problem, Chris. I don't think this is the end of rate cuts. And so what he was trying to say, and I think I understand why he was saying it. He's saying, look, this isn't the beginning of a long rate cutting cycle. And what he's making reference to there is that's what we usually do if we blew it and we're in a recession. Well, obviously, with the unemployment rate at 3.5, the lowest it's been in 50 years, inflation under 2%, and the economy growing at 2%, you can't say, hey, we're in a crisis mode. So here we go. We're going to be slashing until we turn this thing around. And here's another key thing. We're getting in the middle of a presidential election cycle. And usually, you see, the Fed is reluctant to make major policy changes in an election year. They don't want to make it look like they're trying to goose the economy in favor of the current incumbent. So just as, for example, the Fed refrained from doing anything in 2012, and in fact, in 2016, the Fed then under Yellen said, hey, we're going to cut three times. Well, guess what? She only cut once. She waited until December after the November elections were over, when the Fed cut a quarter of a point. Now, Powell, being a Republican, wouldn't want to be seen like Arthur Burns under Nixon, that he's goosing the economy in an election year, although the president may be tweeting him and urging him on.
Well, that brings me back to the question, what do investors do here? And I mentioned our technician, Tom McClellan, thinks that we get a short-term correction and that markets head up from here. But He also pointed out that markets tend to do very well in the third year of a presidential election cycle. Now, as an investor, based on that, what do you do here?
Well, as I discussed earlier, we're in the middle of a global currency war with central banks slashing interest rates in an effort to weaken their currency. That is why, in my opinion, you're seeing gold break out here. So I believe you have to have a position in precious metals, especially gold. And that view is not just me, but a lot of smart investors, including experts here in the program, everyone from Ray Dalio at Bridgewater, Paul Tudor Jones, many of them feel that gold is going to head up to $1,700, including our guest today, Mark Chandler. The second thing I think you have to look at is high-quality dividend-paying stocks. Yields are going to continue to fall, and we could see, Chris, Treasury yields hit 1% or lower. They're already at 2%, and the economy's still growing. So there is going to be a scramble and a hunt for yields globally by institutions and individual investors. If you take a look at what individual investors have been doing this year, they're pouring money in bond funds at record levels, expected to hit $500 trillion. Now, you compare that over 10 years, when inflows to bond funds were only $1.2 trillion, this year we're going to do $500 trillion alone. So what that means is as yields head lower, as bond funds, as they take in this money, they will be forced to buy bonds at a lower yield, which will end up reducing their dividends. And that's why we're a long duration here. We're buying individual bonds when we can find attractive issues with good yields. But my favorite plays here are high-quality dividend stocks with a history of raising dividends, gold, beaten-down tech and healthcare stocks, precious metals, and especially gold.
So in summary, Jim, you expect more rate cuts ahead, not just one and done. And with bond yields, you expect them to head lower. Currency wars are where governments move to debase their currencies. And then finally, in this environment, you're saying high-quality dividend stocks and gold is the way to play what lies ahead. Now, all of that being said, Jim, what do you see coming up here in the weeks ahead?
Well, I think there's going to be a couple things. Number one, we're just about done with corporate earnings season. So in August, you got the Fed conclave at Jackson Hole. So everybody will be looking at what, you know, Fed governors say in that conference. We're also going to be watching the economic numbers because if trade tensions heighten, in other words, Trump really does put those 10% tariffs beginning in September on $300 billion of Chinese goods, and also if the economic numbers continue to weaken, in other words, not improve, because really, is a quarter point cut really going to do anything? Really, all the Fed did was unwind that December rate hike from last December when everybody said that was one rate hike too far. So we're going to be looking at the economic numbers following the trade tensions, and that's going to be coming up. And of course, watching the futures market, because the futures market says the next one is not going to be a quarter of a point. It could be a half a point coming in September. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.